Ladies and gentlemen, it is time once again for an all-new episode of The Cody Springer Show, available on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Music Weekly. Ever since 2018, Cody has given you one of the most real and uncensored podcasts on the internet, talking about real-life issues, pop culture, sports, and everything in between. Welcome to The Cody Springer Show.
All right, guys, I'm back with an all-new episode of The Cody Springer Show, episode number 97, almost on 100 episodes. Today, got an exclusive interview with artist Sean Schuyler, and we had a really good interview, man. We talked about what his inspiration was for music, his time with the Daymakers, and what he's working on right now. So, without any further ado, my interview with Sean Schuyler. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I got another exclusive interview for you guys here on the Cody Springer Show. I have Sean Schuyler here with me. How's it going, Sean?
What's happening, man? It's going well. Going really well.
I'm glad to hear that. So I wanted to start off by asking you, where are you from?
I'm from Chicago, originally, and now I'm living in Nashville, Tennessee.
Nashville... did you decide to move to Nashville because of music, or was it somewhere you always wanted to go?
Yeah, you know, Nashville, definitely for music. I kind of fell in love with Nashville. I think I played my first show here in 2010. So it's kind of a while ago now. And it was always kind of just in the back of my mind, like, you know, the atmosphere here for music is just so great. And for songwriters, and you know, people really appreciate the songwriter here, and that always kind of you don't get that everywhere. You know, in Chicago, it's a music friendly city for sure. And there's been sorry, you can hear my dog clicking around in the background. he won't sit still. Chicago's a music friendly city, and they have had decent scenes there at times, but. You know, for a songwriter, Nashville is just where it's at. You know, you're respected as a songwriter here. People don't look at you funny when you tell them you're a songwriter, as they might, you know, in other places in the country. So it was just always this really attractive place to me. So, you know, I went back after several shows here during that time. I went back to Chicago, and I still kind of kept pounding the pavement there and doing things there. And then eventually it just got to a point where it was like, all right, well, it's kind of now or never time. Let's make this happen. So I've been here for about 3 years, and it was going really, really great up until the pandemic. And now things have been a little, you know, kind of weird the last year, but it's okay.
Right. Yeah. The pandemic's definitely impacted the music scene all around, you know, as far as touring and stuff like that. But, you know, we'll get into that here later on the podcast. But I want to know, what made you want to get into music? Like, this is what I want to do.
Yeah, sorry, let me just try. I'm securing my animal. He will not sit still. My apologies. You know, I grew up around a lot of music. And my parents were always listening to music. My grandpa, he plays piano and accordion. My dad plays guitar. So there was always, you know, musical things happening. And I think that's probably what piqued my interest at first. And then as I got older, I got to have some really kind of charmed rock and roll experiences. And I think that really had a big part in like shaping my desire to want to be in this business. I think I was 12 when I went to a concert with my dad. He took me to a Bush concert in the 90s. And I was probably too young to go to a show like that. But nonetheless, we went, and it was freaking amazing. And he happened to know somebody at his work that, like, it was like a you know, a friend of a coworker or somebody who knew the bass player in the opening act. And the opening act was a band called Veruca Salt. And if you don't know who that is, they were a pretty popular band from Chicago. They were fronted by two women named Louise Post and Nina Gordon, and just a great rock band. They kind of had their moment in the sun in the 90s, and they had some hits, but they, you know, they weren't quite as big as Bush was. But we got to go backstage that night. And I remember him saying specifically, like, drink this all in, buddy, because this does not happen, you know, very often. Like, I've never even been backstage before. So really, you know, this is not a, for your first concert experience, this is not a normal thing. And I remember thinking to myself, like, no, I'm going to be backstage a lot. Like, this is going to be a normal thing for my life. And I think that's kind of where, you know, I've had these little like light bulb moments throughout my life where it was, or my young life where I just felt like, oh, I'm destined to be a part of this in some capacity. So that was a really special moment, just hanging out with that band. And, you know, I'm 12 years old and the band's fronted by these two beautiful women, and I'm just, you know, on cloud nine, just gaga in the corner there. And then a couple of years after that, I snuck backstage at Warped Tour with my buddy, and we ended up hanging out with Green Day for like 2 hours. So I, wow. You know, it was just unbelievable. You know, we hopped a fence, we like risked our lives to get backstage at this show. And I still don't know how we didn't get caught. And we ended up just kind of, we didn't know where their bus was. We just kind of stumbled upon it. And I walk up and Mike Dirnt's there, he's outside the bus at a grill flipping burgers. And then before I could even like turn to my friend and say, holy shit, that's Mike Dirnt. He, sorry, I'm not sure if we could swear on this or not.
Oh, it's all good. You can swear.
Okay. Before I could turn to him and say anything, he was like, hey, what's up, dudes? And we're like, hey, Mike Dirnt. And he's like, you guys want some burgers? And we're like, oh, okay. So he had like some, you know, like lawn chairs out, and we just sat there eating burgers with, and then Trey comes walking off the bus, and then Billy Joe comes walking off the bus. And we're just like, how is this real? How is this real life? And we sat there and we had burgers and we were shooting the shit with Green Day for about, yeah, probably an hour or two.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's just, it's stuff. Yeah. You know, it's the stuff like that where it was just like, oh my gosh, like how could I not grow up and not, you know, not want to be a part of all of that. It always felt so exciting. And I was fortunate to have some really cool moments like that. And that's just a few. I've got more. So I would say that's what kind of got the ball rolling though. I was probably 15 with the Green Day experience. And then after that, it was just like, forget it. Like, this is what I have to do.
Man, that's crazy, man. Like, it's cool in itself that you got to see them in person, and even cooler that they were cool with you guys being there, you know?
They were so nice. Yeah, this was in between probably sometime after Warning came out. So it was pre-American Idiot before things really exploded again for that band. And it was at the perfect time to like meet them, and I guess in a somewhat accessible way, even though not really, because we snuck back there, but I have no regrets.
Oh, I bet not. But yeah, in your music, you know, has been used in several different things. It was used in a web series produced by Kevin Hart called Special Skills. How did that opportunity come about for you?
Networking. A good buddy of mine named Patrick Webb, he's an actor and a very talented writer based out of Chicago. We had actually met doing stand-in work probably 6 years ago now. We were standing in on the One Chicago shows that are shot in town in Chicago. And he and I remained friends, you know, since those days. And he ended up writing and acting in Special Skills with his writing and co-star, Marina Scorsiati. And he just always liked that song. And then, you know, when it came time for them to need intro music, theme music, he ran it up the ladder and it got picked. So it was a pretty simple process. He was kind of just like, hey, I'm doing a thing and I think your song would be perfect. And I was like, okay, cool. here you go, check it out. And then thankfully everybody else thought it was a good idea too. And it all kind of worked out. Yeah, that was a good series. I think you could still find it on YouTube and on, I think it's the Must for Laughs website or something like that. But Kevin Hart ended up producing it, and he has gone on to do, Patrick has gone on to do a bunch of other writing with Marina, and they got a couple of projects that they're working on right now.
Nice. That's really cool. Have you been contacted about, people using their music and other stuff as well? Or was that like the only real opportunity that has presented itself?
There's been a few different instances. A couple of different podcasts have either contracted me out to write, music for their podcast, or they've used existing pieces of my songs. And then there's been some other independent film type stuff. I haven't had like a huge, huge placement yet. I'm kind of working on that. That's you need to be submitting for that kind of stuff. They don't usually just find you unless your song is like a runaway hit or something, and then that's a bit different. But yeah, that's kind of something that I'm with the new stuff, I'm hoping to get a little more into placements.
And speaking of your own songs, your most popular song is 68 Elvis. What was that, your inspiration behind that song?
You know, that was kind of just a quirky one-off song that I wrote that was very different from everything else. And I've just always liked Elvis. And I grew up with an uncle who loves Elvis. And, anytime I'd go by his place, he'd be listening to Elvis, and he'd have like the oldie stations on and stuff like that. And I just thought he was cool. And I always liked the comeback special. When I got a little older and went to Graceland for the first time, I think it was probably maybe 10 years ago or so. We went and toured Graceland, and I really thought, I guess I had an impression of what Graceland was going to be like. And I always thought like, oh, this will be kind of a kitschy, fun Americana thing to go see and do. And it was, but it was so much more than that. Like they do such a great job of like kind of curating his life. And you get such a sense for who he was. And, you walk through these just astonishing award rooms where, all of his gold records are and everything. And the property's, beautiful. And it really just kind of, it turned me from a passive Elvis fan to a more active Elvis fan. And the comeback special in 68, I just thought the way they shot it was so cool. Just everything about it. From the jumpsuits and the guitars and the lighting and the sets, I just always thought it was great. And then I just kind of had the idea one day, like, write a song that's inspired by the comeback special, inspired by Elvis, and use as many references as I can think of, but tell a new story on it. I didn't want to do an Elvis cover, and I didn't want it to be like super cheesy. So I just figured, maybe I could find a way to make like a camel, if you will, they call them camels in art, where it's just a big, kind of a collage of different ideas and images and stuff. So I just took as many ideas as I could from his song titles and lyrics and stuff like that, and then formed my own story around it. And it's one of my more popular songs. I still don't know if people who knew my catalog prior to that, if they're into it or not, because it's kind of different, but I thought it was a fun song. I've always liked it.
And that's the thing, like, Elvis Presley, in my opinion, he was like one of the very true entertainers in music.
Sure.
Like he could just, get a crowd going, like no other. And, and I don't think we've really had someone like Elvis, who is a real stage performer like that,
I mean, yeah, guys who can really, really fearlessly command an audience the way he did. I mean, I think Freddie Mercury had that in him. I think, gosh, who else? Some of the more classic frontmen. I think Steven Tyler's got a bit of that in him. John Bon Jovi's got that in him. newer, like new artists. I don't know. I don't know if I've seen anybody that can really command a stage the way that Elvis can. Maybe Lady Gaga or somebody like that. But it's hard to fill that sort of presence that he had.
Right, it's kind of a lost art, in my opinion. You know, just having that real stage presence, captivate an audience. Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like it's a little bit of a lost art these days. But
for sure, yeah.
But aside from your solo work, you are in a band called the Daymakers. I want to know how you guys came together to form the band.
So, the Daymakers were actually formed. Even though our first official single didn't come out until this year, the band was formed in 2009, I want to say. So we had, I had a bunch of different projects that I was working on. And, you know, whenever you're doing that, especially in the Chicago music scene, the way it was, you know, it was kind of a merry-go-round of players. There was just like new projects starting all the time. And, you know, the drummer from this band ends up being in your band, the guitar player from this band ends up in that band. And it's just kind of this big incestuous scene going on. And I had a couple of projects that I was working on, and the Daymakers actually, it began as a trio, me and the guitar player and the bass player. And we would do like, we were doing at that point in time, you know, coffee shops. And that was kind of our thing. We would play we played the local cafe scene a lot. And then that kind of graduated to playing the bigger clubs and doing, you know, Metro and House of Blues and some of the other kind of iconic. If you're not from the Chicagoland area, you might not know what the Metro is, but it's like kind of one of their more famous small clubs, right in Wrigleyville there. And yeah, we started playing in 2010, like more actively, just building up shows and momentum, and things were going really, really great. We picked up a manager, and there was a bunch of label interest, and there was just everything going kind of right for that band in that year. And then we went out to LA, we cut a record, and then the whole thing kind of fell apart. There was a bunch of, I mean, this could be a whole other podcast, because the story, the rise and fall of the Daymakers is a whole other story. It's a whole nother behind the music special that nobody cares about. But basically we went out to LA, we made a record. It was kind of a bust. The performances were good, but the record itself, sonically, it didn't live up to what we were trying to make. And then there was a bunch of issues with this manager, and things just got wild. And there was like legal issues and stuff going on. And then the band just kind of fizzled out. Like we had all the momentum going. There was label interest. Things were really like right on the cusp. And then things kind of fell apart there. I mean, what really happened, if you want the story, we were sort of discovered, or I was sort of discovered by Art Alexakis from Everclear. And are you familiar with that band?
What band was it again?
It's Everclear.
Yeah, I think I've heard of Everclear before.
They had a string of hits in the 90s and into the early 2000s. And I had met Art, and he liked my music, and we kind of kept in touch for a number of years as I was developing. And then when the Daymakers finally, once I had that band really up and running, he started having me open up for him, which was just incredible, because it really expanded our fan base rapidly. So he was really good to us. And then he was actually... he had an imprint at the time with Capitol Records, and he was going to sign us to Capitol Records, or not to Capitol Records, but to his imprint underneath Capitol. And then unfortunately, with the kind of like changing of the tides in 2010, 2011, and, you know, the whole music industry kind of falling apart, Capitol cut like 70% of their label, including Everclear. And then he lost his imprint. And then the whole thing, you know, the whole house of cards kind of fell. So for up and comers like us, it was pretty devastating, because it was like, we felt like we were just like right there about to grab that brass ring. And then, you know, the whole thing kind of fell apart. So then, you know, in the years since, like I started acting, and I do voiceover work, and I continued and did my, you know, did solo stuff. And the other guys did their own thing too. And then during the pandemic, actually, we started kind of talking again, and we were like, man, you know, that was really fun back then. You know, what if we just decided to put some stuff out and with no expectations, just put it out, see if anybody still cares, see what it sounds like, because we haven't really played together in for the better part of a decade. And so we did that. We had a couple of socially distant rehearsals over the course of the year. That was interesting. And then we put out a single in, I think, early February. We put it out. So a video is going to come out to support that single. And then I don't know where it goes from here. I think we'll probably put out a few more things. It's a little more of a passive project for me. Solo stuff is definitely kind of, you know, what I'm most focused on, but it's a really fun little side project.
So the time frame from when you guys formed to when it all fell apart, how long of a time frame was that?
Pretty quick, about a year and a half, 2 years.
Oh wow.
Mm-hmm.
And then you said you had problems with your manager. Was it over money or
it was over gosh, I don't even know how to describe. It was over, how do I say this? She started to do very unprofessional things. It got a little stalkery.
Oh wow.
She was reaching out, yeah. She was like reaching out, writing letters to like my mom. You know, what's really weird about it and scary about it, you hear about like all this like conservatorship with like Britney Spears, and then you hear about other artists that have had things, you know, had their basically what they've built kind of stripped from them, or people come in and try to like manage the money. People come in and try to like groom certain artists or just set them up so that their finances will not be under their control anymore. And when I look back on everything that she was trying to do to me, including threatening when I was in LA making the record, she had called the studio and she was threatening to try to get me 5150, which is just like,
wow.
I mean, and there was no basis for it other than the fact that I essentially had fired her at that point and was like, you're not going to be a part of this anymore. And she didn't take kindly to that. So she was trying everything in the book. She was writing letters to my girlfriend, to my mother. She was, you know, threatening the studios that she was going to put a lien on the studio. I mean, all this crazy, crazy stuff. Not what you want going on when you're making a record and you're trying to focus and you've got all this, you know, all these things going on. But it's funny because like now that I know more about like this, the conservatorship, like it's a play. Basically, like these people will try to come in and take a young artist and try to control everything about them. So it's like, okay, show pony, you go do the thing that you know how to do, and then we're going to control the rest of it so we can make money off of you. And I mean, I'm not going to speculate, you know, what's going on with Britney Spears. I don't know her situation, but what I've learned of it, it just kind of like my ears perked up because I was like, oh wow, like my manager at the time, like she was in like the earliest seed planting phases of trying to do that to me. Like she was really trying to like set this up so where she wanted me to distrust everybody around me and only trust her. Like she wanted it to be that she was in control of everything. And it's just, it's scary because when you're, I mean, now 10 years removed and, you know, and as a fully grown adult, I can look at this stuff now and see it clearly, but at the time I couldn't. So I totally get, especially, you know, if you're on this roller coaster of fame and, you know, you have all these pressures to perform and make records and do all that, I could totally see how people fall into bad deals.
Oh yeah. It can be quite easy for an artist to fall into, you know, where they're getting scammed and whatnot. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, did you have to end up filing a restraining order against her, or how'd that get resolved?
Yeah, without getting into too much detail, because I mean, I think it's probably safe to talk about all this stuff now. I don't think anybody cares, but I did. Yeah, I had to file an order of protection against her, and there was other things I had, other steps I had to take too, just to make sure that she wasn't gonna continue to like harass my family and. All that fun stuff, or try to, you know, claim any sort of rights over my music. There was just a whole bunch of like crossing of T's and dotting of I's I had to do to make sure that, you know, I was protected at that time. Yeah, it wasn't fun. It was not fun to deal with.
Oh, I bet not, man. Like that's wild. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, especially, you know, for an artist that wasn't known. I mean, like this was all just like preparatory work, you know, that we were trying to launch a thing to become successful. It wasn't successful yet on a micro scale in Chicago. Like people knew who the band was a little bit, but like it wasn't even a regional hit, really. It was just the makings of hopefully something good that, you know, a popcorn kernel that didn't pop. So there's a million stories like that, but yeah, unfortunately I have one of them. I know now to do better and, you know, be careful who you trust and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Some hard lessons learned for sure.
Oh yeah, definitely. So let's transition from that and let's get back on the subject of being on tour. You know, you've done that over the last several years until the pandemic hit. Has it been hard for you not to perform while COVID and everything's been going on?
Yeah, it's been really, really difficult. It's, I mean, apart from, you know, shutting down a revenue stream, it's, you lose that connection with people, you know? You don't get to see anyone that likes your music anymore. And then I mean, not that I have like legions of fans or anything, but the small pockets of fans that I do have that come out to shows, I mean, I really appreciate them. And it sometimes you only get to see them when they come out to shows. So you just start to miss people and you miss that connection. So that part's been difficult. You know, knocking out that revenue stream has been difficult. Thankfully, I do more than one thing. So, you know, taking live performance away from me, it hurt, but I was able to survive this whole time because I just do other things in other artistic avenues. But I'm excited to get back to it. It's been a long time now. Yeah. Over a year.
So, I mean, with, you know, things opening back up and everything like that, how close do you think you are to, performing in front of a live crowd again?
I got my first booking email about 2 weeks ago. So we're going to start to look at dates. It's just tough because like, I know some places are going to have like a lot of like the bigger acts are going to have outdoor shows and, you know, they'll be able to space out. But for guys at my level, it's just really tough because, you know, I'm a club performer. I'm not doing stadiums, obviously. I make my money opening up for larger acts, or if I am the main artist in the bill, it's a smaller club tour, smaller rooms, and they're almost always indoor. So it's like that stuff is still pretty shut down. And I don't know what the rest of the year is going to look like. I'm hoping we can get something going. I'm hoping maybe even the Daymakers can play a show in Chicago somewhere. But yeah, right now I don't know what's going to happen. I got a couple of inquiries here in town, like writer's round kind of stuff and, you know, smaller gigs, which I might do that just to sort of grease the wheels and kind of get back out there. But yesterday I broke my finger. So that was a bonehead thing to do. I was like, I've been gearing up and I'm working on an EP right now and I'm kind of in the middle of recording and I'm doing all the stuff and just working at breakneck speed. And then I think it's broken. I'm just like staring at it right now and it's black and blue. I'm like, oh gosh, like why? And of course it's on my playing hand too. It's not on my strumming hand. So I'm going to be out of commission for about maybe 2 to 3 more weeks in addition to what I thought, but you know, it just is what it is. I think it's going to heal fine. But yeah, I was just, it's funny cause I was so getting excited to play again. And I'm like, oh, maybe in like 2 weeks, I'll just go pop up and do a short set somewhere in town. And it's like, well, yeah, maybe in June.
So do you produce your own music?
It depends. I usually like the studio tracks. I will co-produce typically, or sometimes I'll hand it off to somebody. My typical process is I'll write the most bare bones version of it. I'll kind of track it in my home studio, and I'll work in, you know, as many ideas as I have for the song. I'll try to get that on paper, get the sketch going. And then a lot of the time I'll take it to a producer that I trust and then work with them to kind of like build the track from there. I'm not a great, as they call, track guy. Like some people just like, they hear an acoustic demo and like they can just build a track around it. I'm not really that guy. I'm not well versed enough of an engineer for that, but I do what I do. And my stuff is just very, you know, the things that I produce from my home studio are pretty simple, and I'm learning production a little more, but I've just always been more on the songwriting and performing end, and not as much of a producer. Like I've had people ask me to produce them before, and I've just been like, no, because, well, it's like, if I had a good engineer, I could do it. I know what I want to hear, and I can arrange, but most people in town are producer engineers, and I'm not a seasoned enough engineer to get all the sounds that I want. I would need an engineer there that I could say like, hey, you know, can we do this? And then they can kind of be my hands to make it happen. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's more so, yeah, you would need to have an engineer there to make it sound the way, you know, they would want to, or the way you would want to.
Exactly. Right. Like I love to be there for the process and to kind of like co-direct that sort of thing. But I don't need to be the person, you know, with every keystroke. And I don't think it's healthy. I don't think that music was ever meant to be, you know, so isolated. I think it's a fun experiment to do that. And some artists have done it well. And like, I mean, I think of like McCartney. Paul McCartney's done several records. I think McCartney 1, 2, and 3. He wrote, produced, you know, plays every instrument, does the entire production himself. And I think sometimes that could be really cool. And sometimes you lose something. I think, you know, music should be a little more of a conversation, and you should have input from other people. Even if you wrote, I write all my songs typically myself, but there's still input there. You know, my producer might be like, hey, well, what if we tried this kick instead of this, you know, this kick? And I might be like, oh yeah, that's the one that brings that changes the entire attitude of the song. It could be as simple as that. Like one little, you know, one little piece can just change everything. So I think it's important to have other people's input.
Oh yeah. And music can really be a big collaboration if you let it. I mean, you know, there's other artists I've talked to, and you know, they do everything independently, and that's great, but you know, it can't help to have input from different people.
Yeah, I think so too. I think I've had this happen. There can definitely be too many cooks in the kitchen sometimes, and it could be a bad situation.
Yeah.
And you know, you end up getting less done because there's too much going on. But for the most part, I got a producer in town that I really like and trust a lot. His name is Jared Anderson. He produced 68 Elvis, and he co-produced the Daymakers' last single. He just kind of gets me. I think he gets what I'm going for, and he's very easy to communicate with. So I think if you could find somebody like that, where you guys really can, you know, understand each other, I think it could be a really advantageous thing to have somebody else produce for you.
Oh, definitely. And there's, you know, there's a lot of trust that goes into that as well, for sure.
100%.
So you have a merch store called Sky Supply. Talk a little bit about that, and do you have any new merch dropping soon?
Yeah. So Sky Supply is still kind of it's still in beta mode, if you will. It's very much had a soft release. I launched it last fall, and I did just a very short run of t-shirts, and they sold really well. It was great. Everybody responded super positively to it. It was really fun. And then I kind of took a break from it a bit because I'm retooling it to sort of bring it into the NFT space. And we're going to be doing some stuff with that coming up. So it's yet to kind of like see its full fruition. I'm still kind of figuring all that out of, you know, how exactly, you know, do I want it to simply be a merch store for like my personal stuff, or is it going to branch off and be its entirely own different brand? I'm still kind of like figuring out how I want to approach it. But yeah, I've got a few different t-shirt designs and some like sandals and different kind of like athleisure wear that I'm working on. And I'm not sure when it's going to come out, but I think probably in the fall, I'll be closer to making a bigger drop with that.
Okay. So you talked a little bit earlier that you're working on an EP. Talk a little bit about that. Like, what can we expect? Would it be some, like some of your older music, or is it an entirely different new sound?
It's both, actually. My goal this year is to just release as much music as I can. I've had way too much kind of piling up in the vault. And right now on Spotify, I have very little up there because I pulled my entire catalog. I had three other EPs up there and a record up there. And I pulled it because there was just some stuff that I was unhappy with quality wise, and like, and things were, you know, I've kind of just changed a lot as an artist. Like the direction has changed quite a bit. And those early recordings, I don't ever think you should try to rewrite history by any means, but if there's something up there that you're just like so unhappy with and it doesn't represent you at all anymore, I don't think there's any harm in getting rid of it if you know, people aren't gonna be outraged by it. And some people have been outraged by it. People, I get messages all the time like, hey, where did your Big Mistake EP go? I can't find it anymore. And I'm like, well, it doesn't exist anymore. I've taken it away from you. So it's gonna, and the reason is not that I hate the songs or anything like that, or even the performances, but it was never mixed and mastered properly. It was very much done, you know, just so on the cheap. And sometimes you can get away with that, but this one, we just didn't, you know, it just did not sound up to par. So I'm in the process of getting a lot of that stuff remixed and remastered. And I'm going to put out a collection. Basically, it's going to be like a best of from an artist that you don't know. So I'm going to take all the old EPs and I'm going to kind of cherry pick the best stuff from it. I'm going to put out sort of like a best of my earliest work, essentially. And then for the new stuff, what I've been working on kind of quietly for the last couple of months, but I could finally talk about it a little bit. I have kind of gotten into the NFT space. Do you know much about that?
I know a little bit about it, but I'm not like really knowledgeable about it.
Sure. So NFTs, at least with what I'm doing, I'm minting to OpenSpace, and OpenSpace runs on Ethereum. So NFTs are on the Ethereum blockchain, or at least for my purposes. And what I'm doing for this current EP, I'm kind of documenting the entire process of me making the EP. So I go on to Clubhouse, and sometimes, do you know what Clubhouse is?
I do not.
So Clubhouse is a brand new social media platform. It's in beta mode right now. And if you're an Apple user, you can download it on your iPhone. And I think it's rolling out to Android users in the next week or two. And it's essentially like a virtual conference room, basically. You have what they call a hallway, and then there's a bunch of different rooms people create. And you could have, you know, you could start the Cody Springer Show room, and you could like have people come in, and you could do a live podcast if you wanted to, and you can record it, and you could have people in the audience. And if you want to pull up people from the audience to ask questions, you could do that, or it could just be you and the guest. Like if it were you and I on there right now, you and I could be talking, and there could be people in the audience listening. So it's a pretty cool thing. And there's a lot of different, and that's just one example. You can have rooms for virtually everything, and there are. The thing that kind of turned me on my head, because I just didn't even think about it, I started to see performance rooms, and people are going in Clubhouse rooms and kind of like virtual open mic nights. There's a host, there's a moderator, and then you go around and everybody performs a song and does that kind of thing. And I just thought that that was such a, you know, what a great solution for right now when so many of us still can't get out and play live music. So that's just been so fun. And it got me thinking, okay, well, why don't I, instead of being so precious about the songwriting process and not letting anybody hear anything until it's a finished studio track, what if I invite people in to like be a part of the whole thing? Like if I write a song, you know, that morning, go on Clubhouse, perform it. Who cares? It might be a little clunky. The lyrics will probably change. You know, the song, once it gets to full studio version, will probably be a lot different. But what if I record that performance and then I sell it as a one of one NFT? So now that's what I'm doing. I'm kind of like giving people the opportunity to like watch the songs evolve as I'm working on them. And then I'm selling the performances from Clubhouse as one of one NFTs so that like if you went on OpenSea, you could be the only, like the sole consumer copy owner of that song. Nobody else has it. And I'm calling them, I'm basically bootlegging myself. It's essentially what's happening. Because I was just thinking like, gosh, like I, you know, when I was a little kid, I could walk into a record store and I still remember like going into, it was called Discount Records in Frankfort, Illinois. And I'd walk in and the smell of like lavender incense hits you. And it just smells like a kind of like a hippie record shop, you know? And I'd go thumbing through all these bootlegs and stuff. And there would be obscure recordings of like, you know, I mean, bands like Bush at the time. I'd be thumbing through because I just loved that band. And I would be finding like these weird live recordings that they did in Moscow or, you know, wherever that I just wouldn't have the access to get. And I was thinking, gosh, I missed that. I feel like we don't really have that in the digital age. We don't really have a digital equivalent of like a bootleg type of thing. And a lot of the times there were songs that like didn't make the record. They would just play it live one or two times and that was it. So if you didn't have that bootleg, you didn't have that song. So I was just thinking, maybe this will be kind of fun. Maybe, you know, these weird early versions of these songs, if people want to check them out, and then they can be the only purchaser of it. And on OpenSea, you can resell the NFT as well. So if you like it and you want to give it to a friend or sell it to a friend, you could, you know, you can keep the chain going and people can keep reselling it to each other. It's almost like a little, it's not black market because it's very much, it's as out in the open as it could be, but it has that kind of like bootleggy, you know, exclusive, that feeling of scarcity, I guess.
Yeah, that's all interesting, man. And I'm definitely gonna have to check out Clubhouse when, it's available for Android. Yeah, so I mean that's definitely interesting that they have that available, you know, where people can go to these different rooms and check out your stuff and everything like that. Man, that's pretty cool.
I think it's going to be a pretty big thing. I've had some friends get on and they were a little like apprehensive because they didn't really fully understand it. But I think once you get in some rooms and there's definitely a little bit of stage fright, even for me, just not knowing the app. I mean, all of a sudden you find yourself in a room with, you know, 100 people or a couple hundred people, and you get pulled on stage and everybody's having these conversations about, well, it could be anything. I mean, for me recently, I've been in a lot of rooms just talking about NFTs and talking about blockchain technology and all that kind of stuff, because that's where I'm going with it. But there's rooms for everything. There's rooms for mental health, and there's rooms for, you know, people talking about yoga and people talking about guns and people. It's just the whole, you know, the whole spectrum.
Wow, yeah, that could be groundbreaking for sure.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, I think once it rolls out for Android, I think that it's going to blow up pretty big, or has the potential at least.
I'll definitely have to check it out once it's available. So the last question I got for you is, what's some of your future plans, aside from music?
Apart from music, Well, I am also an actor and a voice actor, and I'm excited that that work's picking up too. Auditions have s slowly started to come back a little bit, so that's pretty promising. I think that's going to only improve as we keep going, and that's pretty much it for the most part. Yeah, I'm mostly focusing on music right now and working on this EP, getting all that ready, breaking into this new space with NFTs and all the blockchain kind of stuff. It's just funny, once you start to peel that onion, it just keeps going and going and going. And like, I'll have friends text me and be like, "Hey, did you hear what happened in the news today about, this politician or whatever?" And I'm just like, man, like I don't know what's going on in the real world. Like I am living in the metaverse right now. Like I'm on Clubhouse. I'm talking like we're in space right now. Like I have no clue what's happening on Earth. And then I turn on the local news and I'm just like, oh God, it's terrible here. I want to go back. Send me back to the metaverse. It's so much more friendly up there. So it's been fun and weird and crazy, and I think we're on the cusp of the music industry changing rapidly again. I think with crypto on the rise and all these new technologies that are going to come out because of it, and now there's even new audio platforms coming out, stuff like Audius, where you can put your music up there the same as Spotify, essentially in terms of basic function, but you're getting paid in crypto. You're not
Oh,
getting
wow.
paid, yeah, and the royalty yield is higher. So it's like, how is that not going to be a game changer? If you could start to have your music on a platform where you're earning more, and you're earning a currency that maybe you're happier with. Maybe you want to get paid in ETH, or I'm not sure what they run on. I'll have to find out. It might be wax, but regardless, I think the industry is in for a major, major shakeup in the next like 6 months to a year. You're going to see a lot of artists dropping stuff on, as NFT projects, and maybe even using like NFT technology to like integrate with concerts. Once all that comes back, you'll probably see. Sorry, if I could talk all day about this stuff. So
Oh
it's
no.
just, yeah.
I mean, crypto is going to be changing a whole lot of things, in my opinion. It's on the rise, and I'm starting to get a little bit into it and trying to educate myself on it more because I'm mining Pi through this app that I have on my phone. And I'm going to be looking more into cryptocurrency because, man, it's really just going to change. Oh, probably our way of life,
Did you see your mining on your phone?
there's an app, it's where you're mining Pi, which is another form of crypto. Let me see.
Oh, it's
Oh
so cool. I didn't
yeah.
even know you can do it in your phone. I did not know that. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean right now, I mean you can't really exchange it or anything at the moment. And because they're waiting to accumulate more users. But yeah, it's called Pi, PI.
Interesting. That's really cool. So that's fascinating, because I'm also involved with something called BitClout. And BitClout, it is essentially, it's like Twitter on the blockchain. And you BitClout, from the way I understand it currently, BitClout is kind of like an offshoot of Bitcoin. And then through the platform that they've built on the BitClout blockchain, you each individual user, your username is actually a creator coin. So like at Sean Schuyler, that's my creator coin. And like, you could go to my page right now and you can support Sean Schuyler by purchasing my coin with BitClout. And as of right now, like there's not, it's kind of the same thing. There's not really an off ramp, because this whole thing is they're trying to just see what this is going to become. But that's kind of fascinating too. I mean, just think of how two apps like that could change social media moving forward, if that becomes a thing.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, it's a wild time right now, man. I think everything very much feels like it's on the cusp of just breaking into a whole new ball game.
Yeah, like now you're teaching me stuff, man.
Definitely get hip to some of this stuff and look it up and see what you think, 'cause I think at least one of the things I mentioned, I think it's probably gonna be here for a minute.
All right. Before we get out of here, go ahead and tell the audience where they can follow you on your social media.
Sure. Essentially everything is at Sean Skyler, SEANSKYLER. And yeah, Instagram, Twitter, BitCloud, Facebook. My website is seanskyler.com. And I think that's just about it for the most part.
All right. Well, Sean, I'd like to thank you for doing this interview. I really appreciate it, man, and I'm looking forward to see what you come up with here in the future with your music and see if what we got going on with the Daymakers.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. Really do. Thanks for having me on to chat about all this stuff. It's been a good time.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Sean Skyler, man. That we had a great conversation, man. Just a lot of cool insight into things and that crypto at the end, man. That conversation was awesome. But yeah, guys, check out Sean Skyler. Check out his music and be on the lookout for what he's got going on in the future. All right. Take care, guys, and I'll talk to you soon. Peace.